when you ask people a question that goes back to the Eisenhower administration, do you think the United States should play a more active role in the world? After some evidence people were getting tired of being active in the world in the late 70s and early 80s, there's been a bounce back, and it's a pretty consistent trend line going back to the 50s that people, most people, think the U.S. should play an active role in world affairs.
The American people and U.S. foreign policy on this edition of Common Ground. Is a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. It's produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Keith Porter. For more than 20 years, the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations has conducted surveys and published reports on what Americans think about U.S. foreign policy. Now that they've done two of these surveys since the end of the Cold War, I asked Council President John Riley if we can now see very clearly what role the public wants the U.S. to play in the world.
I think the answer has to be no in any precise terms. What we did learn, not only through the survey in 95, more preliminary way, the one in 91, is that the public, as well as the leadership, both want the United States to continue to play an active role in the world. They want the United States to remain a global superpower. But they want the United States to remain very active, especially in high priority areas like Europe, the Middle East, and Northeast Asia. When it comes to more precise questions of where we should be involved militarily and when, the public is less precise.
To supplement what John emphasized, one of the striking things about the surveys in 90 and especially 94 is a sense of self-confidence on the part of the public and to some extent the leaders that's growing concerning the role of the United States in the future.
This is Arthur Sear, Vice President and Program Director at the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations.
Last time around, 73% of the public and 43% of the leaders indicated they thought the U.S. would be playing a stronger role 10 years from now than today. That's up in both categories. For the public, though not the leaders, they're much more confident about the role of the United States than about any other country in the world, Japan, China, Germany, for example. This tremendous sense of self-confidence is a great contrast with the late 1970s and early 1980s and should be underscored.
All right. Mr. Riley, can you tell us something about the way the survey instrument was designed and the responses gathered and analyzed?
We once again retained the Gallup organization to do the data collection. Our team of consultants, as well as the people from Gallup, worked with us closely in drawing up the questionnaire. And then the Gallup organization did the data collection, both for the public at large and for the leaders. One of the things that's important to realize in this study is it's both a public study, a public opinion study, and a leadership opinion study. And so for the public, the Gallup organization did what is called a full field study of about 1,530 respondents nationwide, broken down by the usual demographic factors of age, race, income, sex, level of education, geography. Whereas with the leaders are drawn primarily from national organizations, both from the government and from a wide variety of private organizations. The bias in the leadership sample is toward leaders of big organizations, big business organizations, big labor organizations, large universities, as well as from the most relevant agencies of the U.S. government, such as the State Department, the National Security Council, the Commerce Department, the Treasury Department, the Office of the Special Trade Representative. In the Congress, both in the House and in the Senate, the respondents are also drawn heavily from the foreign policy, trade, and security committees of the Congress, both in the House and the Senate.
I'm interested in the split between the public and the leaders and the way you surveyed those two groups. In the results, what stands out in your mind is the way those two groups split in their opinions?
The leaders are much more knowledgeable, of course, about the world in general and the world specifically. They're more likely to have specific opinions. The leaders are consistently more willing to use force overseas, for instance. At the same time, it's important not to be too smug or self-confident. One of the, in thinking you know what people, especially the public at large, are going to do, last time around support for protectionism went up, a slight tick among leaders. Usually they're seen as a free trade crowd. Support for protectionism, despite all the problems that we feel in our economy and everyday life, went down noticeably. And this gets at a good point, I think. They're great for comparative purposes. Playing one off against the other gives you some insights.
Okay. Mr. Riley, part of the challenge of U.S. foreign policy is deciding where U.S. vital interests lie. What kind of guidance did we get from the public on what U.S. vital interests are?
Well, once again, the public indicated that our top priority interests are first with our neighbors Canada and Mexico, and then secondly with our traditional West European allies, Germany, France, Italy, Great Britain. Japan continues to be a very high priority for the United States, which it has been consistently throughout these studies over the last two decades. In recent years, including the study released earlier this year, China plays a much more important role in the eyes of the public than before. And selected Middle Eastern states, especially oil-producing states like Saudi Arabia, continue to be near the top of the public's list of priorities. The leadership has a slightly different ranking and tends to place countries like Japan, Germany, somewhat higher than the public, even though the public places both of those countries relatively high. One of the things we've found over the last two decades is that although the precise ranking of these countries varies a little bit, in virtually all of the studies we've done, and we've now done six over the last 20 years, our immediate neighbors, Europe, a couple of Middle East countries, especially Saudi Arabia and Japan, consistently rank at the top of the areas where the United States public perceives a vital interest.
Mr. Sear, anything to add to that?
No, the vital interest question is a good one, partly because it is somewhat nebulous and indicates at a minimum that people, including the public at large, really see the U.S. as appropriately involved in and affected by what goes on in almost all parts of the world.
Mr. Riley, can you tell us about the role that American jobs and American economic well-being plays in shaping our views of the rest of the world?
When we ask that question, what are the most important foreign policy goals, we have found once again that with the public, protecting the jobs of American workers ranks very high. I think it came in second this time. On several prior occasions, it came in first. As Art Sear has mentioned, there is evident in the results this year a much greater confidence on the part of both the public and the leadership in the competitive position of the United States in the world of the overall relative balance of power in the world. But there is, at the same time, some feeling of personal insecurity on the part of the public, which is revealed once again in that question about concern about protecting jobs. It's interesting on the leadership side, that is never given the same priority. Concern about jobs has been evident too over the years on the question of protectionism or free markets. A good part of the public has associated protectionism with a desire to protect American jobs. As Art Sear pointed out, public support for protectionism this time was down, and actually the lowest level that we found in two decades. It's, I think, 48% of the public is in favor of protectionism. That figure for most of the last two decades has hovered between 60 and 70%, whereas on the leadership side, it's generally been the opposite, with at least two-thirds, sometimes three-quarters of the leaders favoring an open market system and opposing protectionism. And so there has been some shift on the part of the public, reflecting, I think, the recovery of the American economy over the last 3 or 4 years. Nevertheless, there remains a very heightened concern among the public, not only about jobs, but about domestic priorities generally.
All right. Mr. Sear?
Well, picking up on the point about jobs being, and protecting jobs being, the second foreign policy problem mentioned, people are focused heavily on what are normally seen as domestic problems: unemployment, keeping your job, crime, drugs, and that kind of thing. But what's really interesting, as John implied, is that people are also increasingly aware of the fact that foreign and domestic activities are interrelated, and they quite clearly see, and it's a very sophisticated point, that what happens overseas does have a bearing on employment here at home.
We're now well past the end of the Cold War, and we rarely hear mention of the peace dividend anymore. What do people think about military spending in general?
Well, unlike 4 years ago, when there was a very pronounced tendency on the part of both the public and the leadership to cut defense spending drastically, that has changed. Today, by and large, both the public and the leadership want to keep defense spending levels more or less at the level that they are now. Obviously, they have the defense levels have already been reduced substantially. And when we did this study 4 years ago, sentiment on the side of both was very similar to what to the recommendations of candidate Governor Clinton in the autumn of 1992. When we did this study, by the time we did this study and released it in March of 1995, not only had the public and leadership mood shifted on this issue, but Mr. Clinton in office had shifted today, so that in a way, the current administration is taking the view that we should keep defense expenditures more or less at the level they now are, rather than sharply reduce them further. And both the public and the leadership are pretty much on the same wavelengths now. There is little sentiment for dramatically or substantially increasing defense expenditures, as has been advocated by some Republican congressional leaders. But we are struck by the fact that there's quite a difference in attitude today from 4 years ago.
Mr. Sear, anything to add to that?
The people's comfort level with defense is related to self-confidence about our role in the world and a sophisticated awareness of the fact that the United States is inevitably involved in other parts of the world. Support for the NATO alliance also went down 4 years ago and seemed to bounce back in 94. So Americans, who tend to be very stable in their opinions, I think one of the great strengths of our country over time is precisely that, have been true to form in terms of not going in an extreme isolationist or adventurous direction, despite what one might hear in the media and certainly from Washington. People are generally more willing to use troops than they used to be. It's interesting, on this kind of fundamental question, party differences between Republicans and Democrats remain very important. Gender differences are very important, with women generally reluctant, much more reluctant than men, to use military force overseas.
And where do the party lines break down?
Republicans are generally more assertive, more willing to use troops, more in favor of defense spending. There's been a flip-flop of the parties, however. The nice thing about working with Gallup is you can run trend line comparisons going way back to the Eisenhower and Truman years, and earlier if you want. During the Eisenhower administration, the two parties were precisely the reverse. The Democrats were much more anxious to increase defense spending, use troops overseas, and a lot of that was reflected in JFK's successful 1960 campaign. The Republican Party was very much the creature of Eisenhower in that regard. The Republicans were against increasing defense spending and generally reluctant to use force overseas.
We're talking in this edition of Common Ground with John Riley and Arthur Sear, President and Vice President of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. Printed transcripts and audio cassettes of this program are available from Journal Graphics. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details. Common Ground is a service of the Stanley Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that conducts a wide range of programs meant to provoke thought and encourage dialogue on world affairs. Interested to know more, Mr. Riley, about the temperature ratings that you use for countries and world leaders. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yes. In addition to testing the attitude of the American public on where they perceive a vital interest for countries, we use a temperature chart to get their feelings about individual countries, warm, cold, or neutral. This is a more subjective measure than the vital interest chart. And here we often end up with somewhat different conclusions. Once again, Canada and Great Britain come out at the very top of how the American public feels about individual countries, followed by Italy, Germany, Mexico, and France. We also ask the same question of the public, and here only of the public, not of the leaders, about how they feel about world leaders. Once again, Pope John Paul II came out on top, followed by Henry Kissinger, Jimmy Carter, George Bush, and Nelson Mandela. One of the things about the temperature chart related to world leaders is that Americans tend to fare higher than non-Americans because the recognition factor is much higher and the don't know factor is much lower. However, if you factored that out, it would really mean, for example, Warren Christopher, Helmut Kohl, and Isaac Rabin are all at the same level, kind of midway on the chart, where that really means that Helmut Kohl, and Rabin are doing quite well. Secretary of State is not doing so well because he's well below a prior Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. It's interesting also that aside from Pope Paul II, the top foreign leader is Nelson Mandela of South Africa. Anyway, we have found this to be just kind of an interesting way of gauging people's feelings, both about world leaders and about countries.
Mr. Sear, anything else about the temperature ratings?
Well, I think it's really interesting, and a lot of people who aren't inherently interested in foreign policy will be. Of course, I am interested in foreign policy, but it's a good attention-getting device.
Yes.
Henry Kissinger, I hope, likes the thermometer because he's always at the top. He's not quite up with the Pope, but given that he's been out of office for 20 years, mm-hmm. he's doing very well, kind of like the tortoise and the hare. Jimmy Carter, after being down toward the bottom among Americans for a long period of time, has been steadily moving up, so he's now on a par with Henry Kissinger as ex-president.
I was surprised to see that even though Israel has entered into the peace process, that South Africa has radically transformed its government, that their temperature ratings from one survey to the next were roughly the same. Any reason for that you can think of?
South Africa is the same too?
That's the way I read the I think it was the chart.
I haven't really focused on that. One of the things that
one or two points.
One of the things that does come out in the study this time, interest in Africa on the part of both the public and the leadership has been consistently low over the last several decades, whereas today interest in South Africa is really quite high among both. It's not only the fact that Nelson Mandela is highly esteemed, but there are other indications in the report that South Africa is important. That does not mean that other parts of Africa are considered equally important. Whereas with Israel, Israel has consistently been a very high priority country, both on the part of the American public and American leaders. When we ask that question about where would you use troops in a crisis situation, Israel has always come out, not at the top, but certainly among the top half dozen situations. One of the surprises related to the Middle East this time was when we asked people the question where they would like to increase economic assistance to a country or decrease economic assistance. Especially on the leadership side, there was a very strong tendency to very substantially increase aid to the Palestinians, something we found quite surprising and something was not reflected in terms of aid to other Middle East countries, including Israel.
Did you have something else, Mr. Sear?
Well, just as a footnote, if I recall correctly, I think the leaders were notably more, noticeably at least, more positive toward Israel this last time around. And interest, as John said, interest in South Africa was greater than in the past.
Our program deals with international affairs, so we'd certainly be interested to know what you learned about the public's interest in international news and perhaps how it corresponds with their view of the U.S. and the world.
What we did not ask a question this time about where you get your sources of information, because pretty consistently the public had responded. They get it from television, from radio, from newspapers, foreign policy journals. What we did ask is what are your priorities in terms of local news, national news, and news about foreign countries? And there was a slight increase on the part of interest in local news and national news, and a slight decrease in the interest in news about other countries. Not a dramatic one, but I think it does reflect the fact that since the end of the Cold War, despite the fact that both the public and leaders want the United States to continue playing a very active role in the world, there is now more attention being focused on domestic issues than was the case prior to 1989.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Sear?
I think one can infer that that may be more related to the end of the Cold War than any kind of moving inward, given responses to other questions on the part of the public. One of my favorite questions, and one of the most reassuring answers, is when you ask people a question that goes back to the Eisenhower administration: do you think the United States should play a more active role in the world? After some evidence people were getting tired of being active in the world in the late 70s and early 80s, there's been a bounce back, and it's a pretty consistent trend line going back to the 50s that most people think the U.S. should play an active role in the world affairs.
That's interesting. Well, I have just one final question I'll ask each of you. We're entering into an election cycle now. If you were the advisor to a presidential candidate, what would this survey data tell you about how your candidate should talk about these issues when they're in front of the American people?
I think one of the strongest pieces of advice I would give to candidates is to resist the temptation to pander to certain interests and certain trends of opinion that flow in a nationalist and isolationist direction. We have at least one candidate, possibly two out there, who are basically saying the United States should withdraw, the United States should pursue its own interests the United States should, if not formally withdraw, substantially reduce involvement in international and multilateral institutions. I think that's a big mistake. One of the things that has characterized Senator Dole's career, his long public career, is basically he's been an internationalist. He's been supportive of most American administrations in their foreign policy, whether Democratic or Republican. He is now being pushed by certain elements in the Republican Party, certain leaders who are competing in the primary process, to back off centrist internationalist positions which he's taken. Certainly President Clinton is not tempted to do that. I would hope that the primary selection process proceeds in a way that would not force men and women candidates, if there are those, who have taken a very strong internationalist position throughout their career, to abandon that for temporary, short-term political advantage, and adopt positions which, one, they don't believe in, two, really could be quite damaging in terms of American foreign policy and American role in the world, positions which would certainly come back to haunt them months later if they were elected president.
All right, and Mr. Sear.
If you're going to be president, you have to be a statesman in the non-cliché sense of the term. You have to have a large and comprehensive vision of things. You've got to be able to communicate that clearly. And you've got to be able to reassure people that you're an effective executive who's not going to do anything reckless or silly. I can't think of a president who's been considered successful who didn't fulfill that role pretty effectively. Reagan, I don't think, did during his first term. He certainly did in his second term, and I think that was a crucial ingredient, along with his personal rapport with the voters, in his reelection and a pretty successful second term in terms of his public standing. George Shultz, my own personal guess, has played a big role in that. But the more important point is, if you want to be president, as well as be an effective president, you have to appeal to this higher level, I think, of public interest and public concern. Candidates often don't do that, and in fact, invariably, successful candidates, along with unsuccessful candidates, are very partisan in foreign policy, but the separate dimension has to be there.
That is Arthur Sear, Vice President of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. Our other guest was Council President John Riley. For Common Ground, I'm Keith Porter. For a printed transcript or an audio cassette of this program, please send $5 per transcript or $11.70 per cassette to Common Ground, show number 9538, Journal Graphics, 1535 Grant Street, Denver, Colorado, 80203. Again, ask for program number 9538. To order by credit card, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. If you'd like more information about the Stanley Foundation or you have some comment about the program, please write to us at 216 Sycamore Street, Muscatine, Iowa, 52761. Again, the toll-free number to order cassettes or transcripts is 1-800-825-5746. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground was produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.